Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Justin McElloy, and Justin has served as a speechwriter for James Mattis, David Petraeus, and Leon Panetta. He is a former cross-country runner, and in this conversation, we spoke about ideas. We spoke about what a book of wisdom is, what Justin would put in his book of wisdom, Tim Ferriss and Balaji's epic podcast, and how he might know that podcast better than anyone in the world. We talked about what he learned from his collegiate head coach. And overall, this was a beautiful conversation of ideas of someone who is a thinker, is trying to pursue the highest version of himself. And I really enjoyed it. I hope you do as well. And if you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at HeyDannyMiranda. But for now, let's get right into the conversation with Justin McElloy.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Justin, thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Danny. Great to be here.
So we had such a great conversation on the phone that we didn't record, unfortunately. But I'm happy that we got that first initial talk because gave me a sense for who you are. But then I went and researched further and dived deep on you further. And it's been really interesting getting to know you through the internet. And the first question I have for you is about reaching out to a SportsCenter anchor. What was that experience like?
That was... I was obsessed in my high school days with SportsCenter, specifically to watch Michael Jordan highlights. And the SportsCenter at that time was fairly new. I think it had been on the air since maybe the early 80s or mid 80s, something like that. I could be completely wrong, but it was just it was like MTV at the time. It was the thing to do, especially if you're obsessed with sports. And there was an anchor on SportsCenter named Stuart Scott. And he was just unbelievably expressive, a terrific writer. And he captured my attention. And he had a way of describing sports and sports highlights, and specifically Michael Jordan highlights and baseball highlights, which I didn't really love. But he coined the term cooler than the other side of the pillow. And I think we're all familiar with him. And he had passed away, unfortunately, several years ago. But I, in my late high school days, started to write, and I enjoyed the act of writing. And at that time, email, was, sort of the newfangled way of reaching out to folks. So I wrote a note directly to the SportsCenter, hotline or email address, which was just, it wasn't even a person. It was like, editors at sportscenter.com or something like that. They got back to me within minutes. My question was, do the anchors write their own copy? Do they write their own material? And I couldn't believe that you could put out such high quality content every single day, every single night these people would do this. And it seemed like they had such a strong facility with words and with sort of capturing this the action, if you will. And they said, believe it or not, every one of our anchors writes all of their own copy for every single show with no assistance. And it blew my mind that you could do that. And then I wrote something more recently after Stuart Scott passed away, just thanking him for sort of, seizing my imagination back in the day.
Do you remember who actually responded to you?
No, I don't. But how did you find that out, by the way? You did your research.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, it's just got to pay attention to what you're doing. So along the same lines, Justin, how's your rhythm?
Great question. It's my favorite question to ask other people. I believe that question allows you it allows the person you're asking it to take it in any direction. And it's a question that my college track and cross country coach, Al Cantello, used to ask people. And he asked it frequently enough that it just sort of stuck with me as a perfect open-ended non sequitur that someone could just tell you how they're feeling, how they're really doing. You're not really asking how they're doing. It's sort of a trick question. How's your rhythm? And they will automatically admit things to you when you ask that question. They'll be like, ah, my life's a shit show, or I can't sleep, or I didn't, I'm sleeping in too much, or something like that. And they sort of give away a bit more about themselves. They let down their guard. They're not defensive with you if you just ask, how's your rhythm? And typically people who are happy and productive, they have a great rhythm in their life. It's not like this situation where it's completely erratic. And it's possible that people could have like massively erratic schedules and do well or be super happy. And spontaneity is something that I value massively. They used to call me like just in time, like time zero, like meaning I was just focused on the present, living in the present. As a parent, you can't do that necessarily. As an adult, you really can't live nearly in the present. But I'll actually answer the question after that long response. My rhythm is okay. It could be much better. I think, stretched far too thin right now with several projects, which I can talk to you about. I'm certainly not waking up, except for yesterday morning. I woke up at 4:49 a.m. to go for a workout with a buddy at 5. That was awesome, but that is few and far between at the moment. And I need to go to bed earlier and get up without a snooze.
And I'll have sorry to cut you off. Why do you think that how's your rhythm is such a better question than how are you doing?
I just think it's more evocative in the sense of like it immediately evokes in the person who receives that question, like a more specific set, it offers a constraint that is typically not there when you say, how are you doing? Because how are you doing? You could take that in any direction as well. But the constraint is like, what is the like circadian aspect of your life? And that can be both positive or negative. And so I think it pulls out of people interesting responses. And, you know, it just starts a conversation that's natural and human.
Yeah, that makes sense. So on the topic of Al Cantello and running, you know, you ran it at Navy. So what was that experience like as a varsity runner and spending time and being a captain on the Navy team?
Yeah, I absolutely love running. And I don't do it nearly enough now. I have been in a negative spiral because I keep getting a metatarsal problem with my right foot. And, you know, anytime I get above 20 miles a week now, it just like starts to become a massive problem. I'm also a little too lazy at the moment. But back to your question. The Naval Academy is itself a pretty Spartan environment. And so, you know, there is a daily rhythm. There is a discipline there. And you never, like, I would set my alarm, be out of bed with my shoes on less than 2 minutes later and running, like, 30 seconds after that, every single morning. I ran like literally every morning for 1,000 straight days or something like that.
Wow.
And you run twice a day when you're at that level. You're 80 to 100 miles a week. But actually, I forget the exact question that you asked. But yes, can you restate it actually?
Yeah, sure. What did you learn at Navy running?
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, running at its essence teaches you one concept: look ahead, for life is hard. In other words, prepare. The starting line creeps up on you, and come rain, come flood, come mud, you will be on the starting line before you know it. So prepare, and prepare well. Like that's literally the one concept that running teaches you. And it follows like sort of, it follows from the nature of war. It's a competition. You're involved in a competition and you're not like elected across the finish line. You literally, the coach Al Cantello would say, you know, the Kenyan that's standing next to you on the starting line doesn't give a shit whether you, had a great date the night before or whether you look good in a suit. Like all that matters is how much you prepared and how hard you worked. And I love that. And it's sort of like, on the one hand, life teaches you, running teaches you about competition, but Al Cantello, I think, took it to another level. That the longtime coach at the academy, he basically taught us that there was more to life than competition. And he would say, you know, someday, many years from now, you're going to be, you know, rocking your baby to sleep, but today you're going to curse the day you were born. In other words, we're going to have a very hard workout today. Like, but that's going to be teaching you for the rest of your life that to deal with adversity. And like how much pain you're about to be in from this workout today will allow you to get through those nights when you are sleepless with a crying 6-month-old. And so it like sort of steals you. He said it basically, it introduces you to prehistoric pursuits. It gets you closer to that, like, you know, where your bare feet, you know, with a Bengal tiger chasing after you, like that sort of part of our humanity. But again, it's like there's a larger lesson that like life is about competition, but it's also about collaboration and cooperation. And so anyway, I love how running connects you with that part of yourself and with nature, for example.
It's really interesting that you bring up competition, because in 2008, you created some rules for life that were based in hindsight on competition, and you showed them to your parents. And they were like, yeah, these are great, but... So could you talk on how your parents reflected on your 2008 rules for life and how they were so... their perspective on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a genuine effort between me and maybe three other close friends to put in writing, like, what is a distilled version? Like, if you... What's the atomic unit of the rules that should govern your behavior in life? And we sort of like, if you reverse engineer what would be a great outcomes, like how do you achieve those? What are the rules, the principles you should follow? And in part, it was in jest. Like there was like, we try to push ourselves. But what we ended up doing is going in, like we split life into two and we only chose one side of life, like the competitive side of life. And we had one, older professor at the academy, a civilian guy who is terrific, a photographic memory, very entertaining guy. And he sort of pushed us in this direction. But they were, the rules were like, you know, never show weakness. I wish I could just rattle them all off for you. Like life is a competition. Act accordingly. If you want to make friends, win. You know, stuff like that. And I showed them not only my folks, but a couple of friends who are maybe 5-10 years older than me. And my folks replied, these are the rules of a child. Like you haven't learned anything in your 22 years of life, or even later at that time. And they replied with their own rules. And they were terrific. I still have both sets, like the hard copy of each set, which are terrific. And I shared them in a short blog post at some point. But they were more like, you know, life, you get what you give, you know, like life is a circle. What goes around comes around. It's like lots of like hard won wisdom that you get in older age. And then what I did at that time, the reason I sort of put them down in writing and then reunited with that later was, you know, having a child causes you to be introspective and to think like, what are the rules of life that you're going to pass on to the next generation? So I basically tried to write a letter to my new son and offer some thoughts about, you know, if I pass away, you know, here's what I've learned in this short period of time on earth.
How do you think about... There are hard-won wisdom and there's real stuff that we can gain, but the world is also changing at such a rapid pace. So how do you think about the lessons that will hold true no matter if it's 2050 and the world is looking completely different, or 1950 or 2150? Like, how do you think about the changing world and the wisdom that we need to apply to it?
Yeah. This is not going to be, I would say, a profound answer, but I think you're onto something with this question, because it's what Jeff Bezos uses when he runs Amazon. It's like, don't think about what's changing with technology. Think about the things that are never going to change. Customers want low prices, they want convenience, and they want the package on their door in a minute. And there was one other thing that I found very interesting. I was thinking about literally in like the past 24 hours about this topic, which let's table it for a second. But there is like something that I've actually wanted to tweet about on this precise thing about things that change and things that don't change. So let's let it marinate, and then it'll come back to me later in the conversation.
Fair enough. I'd like to go to General James Mattis encouraging you to build a book of wisdom. What are some of the pillars of that book of wisdom, would you say?
Yeah, thanks for that question. General Jim Mattis, for those who are unaware, has spent 40 years in the U.S. Marine Corps and rose the ranks to become a four-star general, and spent more time as a four-star general than I had ever spent in the military when I started working for him. So it's just like he had seen it all, done it all, and he is a voracious reader. And early in his career, he hitchhiked to San Francisco from, I think, the middle of Washington State to meet up with an author who was a longshoreman named Eric Hoffer. Eric Hoffer is like a philosopher, like an unemployed philosopher / writer, who is deeply profound. And he wrote books like The True Believer, which is a really like fascinating tale of extremism, like how people join. I don't want to use the word cults, but more or less, you know, the extremist ideology. And so Jim Mattis, a young Jim Mattis at the time, said, you know, do you have any life advice for me? And he said, keep a book of wisdom. Everything that you read, you should grab the excerpts. And this goes back to Erasmus. This goes back to the 16th century, after the introduction of the printing press. The idea was to take all of the profound things that you're reading and put them into one common place. In other words, commonplacing as a practice. And that practice generates an abundance of thoughts, because you've got the serendipity of one thought colliding with another. And this is the same philosophy that David Perel teaches. It's like it's universally applicable. And Jim Mattis did it in hard copy. And every time that I would write a speech with him, he would demand that I look at his book of wisdom that he had compiled over 30 years. Now, there was a point at which he lost his entire book of wisdom because it got lost in a fire, which is just tragic. But he had like systematically rebuilt it over time. So these are three ring binders with, you know, three hole punch, where he would write out in longhand all of the thoughts that he was encountering, from, you know, Yogi Berra all the way up to super serious content. And every time he would open these binders, they would just fill him with thoughts. And so it's like the opposite of writer's block. You're instantly filled with thoughts. It's almost like a nuclear reaction where, you know, one thought collides with the next and it creates six more. So yeah, I mean, in terms of my own book of wisdom, I call it Thoughts Worth Keeping. And so I have a file on my computer that is an Excel spreadsheet where, you know, you excerpt things into it. Now, I started a company that was based on this precise school of thought, and it was called Erasmus. In 2018, I left Palantir, which is a big data management company, and I said, let's take what we learned from my 4.5 years at Palantir, and three of us started a company that would take a lot of those same principles and apply them to consumer content management. Now, we're all bombarded by terrific, like your podcast content and, you know, everything else that we're seeing in our feeds on an hourly basis. Our thesis for the company was that consumers are going to have the same data complexity in the next decade that entire enterprises do today. So you need something just as powerful as Palantir, but for the consumer side. in any event, that company failed due to, you know, a loss of trust and confidence among the co-founding team. So anyway, long-winded answer to your wonderful question.
What are some of those things on that Excel sheet that you could share?
Oh, wow. I'd have to open it up. Sometimes I even jot notes down to myself, you know, and they have like little JDM, my initials next to them rather than the actual source. I've got things ranging from, you know, the only way to create true change is to open a possibility that you cannot even argue with. And that is a quote from Blark Engels, who's a Danish architect. And architects are great storytellers. They're great, you know, at narrative. The way you win, like, the competition to rebuild the World Trade Center is not to have the best design. It's to tell the best story and to open up a new possibility in people's heads. And so I often will, like, change and innovation are topics of interest to me. So, like, thoughts like that I like to keep down. Politics is also interesting to me, although I don't really tweet about it all that much really anymore. And I don't really have an interest. The more I get into the creative and creator economy, the less interested I am in politics necessarily, even though I used to work in that world. You know, Johnny Ive has quotes about, like, bringing order to complexity, and, you know, how it's not like the absence of ornamentation that is creates a great user experience, or is like the most simple thing. It's like bringing order to a very complex system. And that, I think, is a better way than just stripping something down to its essence. You're ordering something. You're not just like deleting sentences. That makes sense.
Yeah, and that's what you do so well. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But first, why do you think you're so drawn to change and innovation?
I have no idea. I've always been, I think, on the more creative side of things rather than the, like, more technical engineering, although they're one and the same in essence. Like, I think people would describe me, maybe I'm just not self-aware about this, but I think they would describe me as a highly creative person, meaning you not just have ideas, but you actually try to build something with your ideas. You try to, like, put them into the world, like create something out of them. They would say I'm better at that than I am at, like, pure execution. Like, I'd be better as a big idea guy for a company rather than, like, an operations manager in charge of all the details of everything getting done. And that's, you know, maybe a terrible thing to admit. And, like, so at Palantir, for example, we sued our number one customer. And that was a highly controversial decision within the company that would cost the company ultimately several million dollars to go to court, to go to the general, the GAO level, and then to the U.S. Court of Federal Claims with one of the best law firms in the country suing the United States Army. You know, like, that is not something you do cavalierly. Like, the Department of Justice is involved in a court case like that. But ultimately, like, I think where I would excel in helping one of the, being part of the team that was the architect of this court case, which we ultimately won, and then Palantir won a large contract after that. One of the things that I think I contributed in that process was a series of big ideas, like pulling together an argument that we could make that was compelling for the judge to say, this is... you can't rule in any other way than in Palantir's favor. And so, like, even like the night before our terrific lawyer delivered the opening argument, I said, well, there's no better reasoning than the following that we could introduce as, like, the first several sentences you could say to the judge. And I'm not taking credit for our court case because it was a huge team of wonderful people working on it. But that, I think, is like pulling together those threads is what I think I can do well.
What makes a great big idea?
I think a big idea is one that pulls together that, okay, let me put it this way. Creating something new requires taking something apart to its constituent parts. So the more you take things apart down to the atomic level, you start to see that all of those things at the higher level are resolved together into one like fundamental idea. And you could have like, it's almost like there's this guy, I've never talked about this, but Stephen Wolfram, like you could have a very complex system that's based on a very simple set of rules. Like you could have five lines in a computer program that if it's run progressively or recursively, it could create like massive complexity in the long run. Like reverse engineering from the massive complexity down to the like five lines of computer code is, I think, what a big idea is. And, you know, David Petraeus would say, like, you know, you have to get the big ideas right before you can then oversee their implementation in real life, in practice. And then you see how they're actually behaving in practice and you establish a feedback loop, which further strengthens the big idea. And I think, like, when you're pitching a new business, for example, you could have a vague notion of what you're pitching, but until you talk to 100 different people about it, you can't express it in one sentence. You go from expressing it in 10 minutes. You're like, here's what I'm kind of thinking about building. And then 100 conversations later, you're like, I am building this. And it's like one precise and succinct explanation in five words. You know, I wasn't able to say we were building a consumer content management platform until we had, you know, until the company that I founded was 6 months old. It just didn't click with such brevity. And so I think that is what a big idea is. And I think it's possible to reverse engineer them from a series of other sort of manifestations, fresh and novel ways of expressing these big ideas.
You know, it's so interesting because consumer content management system means something very specific to you because you had the big idea, you had a bunch of stuff and you compressed it down to that one sentence. But to me, and maybe people listening, I don't know what that means. So could you explain that and extrapolate what a consumer content management system actually is in your perspective?
Yeah, well, I mean, we built a beta of one and I loved using it. It was just a great experience to use it. It no longer exists, but there's lots of different versions of this that are currently in experimentation around the internet. I don't think they're taking the right technical or cultural approach to solving the problem. So I think it's still an unsolved, or it's not an elegantly solved problem. But like on the one hand, you've got like Rome research. On the other hand, you've got Notion. On the other hand, you have Pocket. On the other hand, you've like there's lots of ways that you can manage your information in your life. But consumer content management, in the way I think of it, is there's lots of different data sources: YouTube, Spotify, Twitter, long form essays, all of these different. Content sources in your life that you encounter on a daily basis. What you want to do is to extract from each of those sources with the metadata. So let's say you highlight one line from an article. You want to take all the metadata from that article, like the URL, the author, the title, all of that stuff. And you want to have these data, these enriched data objects all collide together on the back end. And that's what Palantir's secret sauce is. It's like this brilliant system that connects all the metadata on the back end and makes it really intuitive to use on the front end. There's a great app now that I think is a good proxy of what we were trying to build, but with a different angle on it. It's called MyMind, and it's designed by Tobias von Schneider, who is a terrific world-class designer. So he's a visual graphic designer. But clearly also a good, talented product developer. And so I would suggest anyone to check out that product, MyMind. And it has a different philosophy than what I'm articulating, because he grabs all the metadata from the things that you're encountering and excerpting. But his whole philosophy is that AI on the back end should surface to you and resurface to you the content that you've enjoyed, that's resonated with you the most.
So it would be like if someone enjoyed this part of the podcast, they could in 2 seconds say, okay, I want a clip from here to here. And then it would go to that big source. And then you'd have that for future consumption, like circling back to Mattis's Book of Correct. Wisdom, creating Correct. That online.
Yeah. So, and I constantly in conversations like this realize I'm a terrible storyteller. I never really got to the point of Mattis like inspiring me to build my own book of wisdom. And then I started a company around the same topic. Like he basically challenged me at one point, go build not a business around this, but go build your book of wisdom, but do it in a digital way, like which will be far more powerful than the way I do it, even though I kind of love my hard copy way, but I'm a dinosaur. It's sort of like, go do this. It will change your life. And so I agree, you know, like I want to pass that forward to other folks. And the people who are prolific these days all seem to have a systematic note-taking system like that. And mine is probably a 2 out of 10. I want to like massively amplify my note-taking system. So I think I'll get better if I do that.
You know, you mentioned you think you're not a great storyteller, and I disagree, but do you think that is a result, your comparison of being writing for some of the great storytellers like Mattis or Petraeus, like, and people like that?
Yeah. So again, I think there are some people who are gifted storytellers, and I don't know whether that's innate or developed, but they have a gift. My, you know, brother, I always like sort of hold up there as a guy who can hold you in rapt attention and, you know, make you laugh at the same time. I just don't think I have that gene. However, I work at it a lot. And so like the process of writing will distill down these ideas in a way that are digestible and understandable and comprehensible and all that stuff. And so where I excel, I think, is just the sheer hard work of writing. Like I will sit in front of a computer, and now I've been trained by people who are excellent editors. So, you know, Mattis will, he taught me like sort of the art and the science of this. You have to hit a person in their head and their heart at the same time. And if you can marry those two things together, you have their attention. And so I would say, like, I always talk about like Taylor Swift's song 22 is, it like reaches you emotionally. And it also, you know, like has a point to make, but it like a 70-year-old has a 22-year-old in her or in him. There's a 22-year-old in all of us. And like it reaches that emotional state and it reaches an intellectual state at the same time. So yeah, I mean, the thing, like what they, I think, taught me is like this whole idea that like you have to reach an audience. We gave a great speech at West Point. He gave the speech, I helped him write it. And this is a commencement at West Point. I can't remember exactly what year it was. But he said, look, I want this speech to be 2 minutes long. And I said, like, because you could say more in 2 minutes than you can say in 10 minutes is his point. And he said, start with the sentiment, like start with the sentiment of where these people are going in their lives. They are sitting in front of you about to matriculate into a competitive world. And this gets back to an earlier part of our conversation. And I had like drafted things that were like, you know, we are at the bedrock of American whatever. And he just like sort of scratched out that whole paragraph. And he said, when you were in first grade classrooms spread across America, the Twin Towers were attacked. You know, it's like a very like he hit them right in there, like right where they were as human beings. And, you know, at that time, there was an attack, like there was a terrorist attack in England and Manchester. And he's like, Manchester's tragic loss underscores a salient point. And like, you know, that is his talent that has, I think, hopefully started to internalize in myself, is like, put yourself in that person's shoes as a human being, if that makes sense.
Yeah. How much of that, and I asked you this question when we spoke initially, but how much of being forced to be in someone else's shoes, constantly writing for these generals and different individuals, how much of that has taken away from your own voice?
I think now I've grown past the downsides of it, and I'm now reaping maybe potentially some of the upsides of it. You know, in David Petraeus' case, he was a speechwriter twice in his early career, and he clearly gained from that experience. As he said, you know, you look down the barrel of an M16 when you're a, you know, a young Army captain or a young Navy lieutenant, and you can't see the forest for the trees. You literally aren't in that helicopter looking down at a strategic level, and you're getting the world's greatest gift. You're going to every meeting of a 4-star general as a lieutenant who's 28 or something like that. And I can't remember exactly what angle your question was directed, but voice. So it is a very intimate experience to write for people like this. You have to intellectually channel them and take on the mental responsibility and the outcome for the organization, or else you're not going to help the 4-star or anybody who's leading the Pentagon, a 3 million person organization. You would be incapable of helping them think via the process of writing if you're not getting, you know, like if you're not in their head and thinking not only like how would they put this, but like what are we trying to do? And you lose yourself and your own voice in that process. It is an emotionally exhausting experience. Having wrote first for Petraeus, then Mattis, then Panetta, three different talking styles, three different writing philosophies and styles, I lost my own voice in that process. I think I'm regaining it. And here's a cool thing. The more you share, the more you develop and discover your own voice, but you can't do it in a vacuum. You need not only to like create, but also to publish and to share and get feedback. And that loop like further helps you discover more about yourself and sort of how you like to communicate. But so it took me years after this where I still have a hard time editing sentences and getting out of like the Mattis voice or the Petraeus voice. If that makes sense. And the Panetta voice, he has a like his own skill and gift. It was like, what do people give a shit about? He would read a 10-page speech, edit one line, and that would be the line that was quoted by the press the next day, invariably. And I always found that incredibly, like, that was not luck. He had been around DC for 40 years, and he could get to the point of, like, what's the headline? He would start meetings, like speechwriting meetings and other meetings with like, you know, the general counsel of the Pentagon or, you know, the person who is in charge of Middle East policy and say, what's the headline? What are we trying to do here? Put it in a sentence. And, editing that like principal goal, that singular goal, that unmistakable single message that you're trying to get across or convey, like that is probably the highest leverage thing you can do as a writer or a thinker or a communicator.
How do you think he was able to just look at a huge piece of writing and just find the headline in 2 seconds?
I think it's pattern recognition. And he like comes across as an affable guy who isn't like the most intellectual person. Like there's other people who have an affect to them that's more intellectual. But that doesn't mean he isn't a student of human nature. Like he gets to, you know... like the one nugget that like is the essence of the problem. Like what problem are we trying to solve and what like message are we trying to communicate about solving that problem? Like define the problem down as to a Jesuit's level, like get it down, like define it 4 layers down for me on a human level. And that is what people are going to care about. That's what they're going to respond to. Journalists and comedians are excellent at this. And I just want to state for the record, I've been a speechwriter and I've learned a lot about writing from that process, but I cannot produce high quality things at a high rate of speed the way journalists and comedians can. It's just like, I find that to be one of the most impressive things. And there's a lot of people on Twitter who are like equally as prolific with high quality stuff. And I always admire and look up to them. And many of them I've summarized.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll talk about some of that. But I think you do have a gift in the quality that you produce. Maybe it's not at the speed you would like, but this is a quote from your mom, which says, "You have the gift," referring to your writing, I believe. "Now, please make the time to scoot over to the USNA Athletic Department and begin that great memoir of that one person who inspired you in many ways. Time is ticking." What is she referring to? And have you started the memoir?
I have not started that memoir. That would be a biography of, it would be not necessarily a biography, the full life story, but it would be a story from a limited perspective, the soda straw that I have of my former coach, Al Cantello, who I've mentioned already. I believe that he represents and embodies and has tried to pass along a philosophy of life that I think is helpful. So it's almost like what I would like to do is a series of conversations with him that then I could, you know, distill into a set of big ideas around this, almost like more of like a Tuesdays with Maury story, if you will. Yeah, I have not started that, and I ought to reach out to Al far more than I do, and I, you know, racked by guilt by that. But just another thought there, and this is perhaps a non sequitur, but he turned me on to a paragraph that I read at some point. It was a speech delivered by a person named Harry Parker, who is the coach of the Yale crew and rowing teams for 40 or 50 years or something like that. And as he was retiring, he gave a speech to some of his former athletes. And a lot of them had given glowing speeches prior to his, saying how much he'd impacted their lives. And, "You taught me so much, coach." And he said, "I just want to disabuse you of this notion that I taught you anything. The sport of rowing taught you about life. I just was sort of a bit player that helped you get into the sport, which taught you about life." And I just thought that was a really interesting thing. And so, you know, it wouldn't be some like hagiography of Al. I think there's no unalloyed heroes in the world, really. But it's like he dedicated his life to the purpose of introducing us to these prehistoric pursuits, which then taught us about life.
What would be the first or a few questions you would ask Al?
"How's your rhythm?" I have asked him a lot of these questions in ham-handed ways, and I always do it in ways that are too obvious. Like, "Al, what did you try to teach us? What did you try to teach your runners?" That's a terrible question. It's like impossible for him to sum that up in 5 sentences. You know what I mean? The best way to do this, I think, is to get him telling stories about his athletes and what they achieved, or the times that they failed miserably. Just get into the meat of the concrete, like, you know, almost like bring us to a starting line and tell us about the fourth place finisher in the heptagonal league championships in 1992. And tell us about that person, that human being, because he actually has an unbelievable recall. He remembers my races better than I remember my races, which I think, and by the way, he was never a runner. He was a javelin thrower. And he would have a way the night before the race or right before the race of knowing what it felt like 4 miles into a 5 mile run. And it is a psychological talent to the extreme. Like, he coaches are psychologists, and he would get into your head in that moment in a way that like any runner isn't capable of expressing. That was his magic. So, like, you know, describe what goes through a runner's head, Al, stuff like that. Like, you know, those are the sorts of questions. And by the way, you're giving me a great idea. I should have this conversation tonight.
Yeah. The benefit of Zoom and the benefit of being able to, the internet, is that you can have these incredible conversations with coaches, parents, and you don't even need to be in the same location, which is incredible. On that same line and topic is Balaji and Tim Ferriss using the internet. So you've said to me that you believe you know this conversation between Balaji and Tim Ferriss, which for those of you who are uninitiated is probably the greatest podcast I've listened to in the past year, and just an incredible conversation that I highly recommend. And you summarize this conversation, this 3.5 hour long conversation. How long did that summarization take?
I hate to admit how long it takes me to do these things. It is forever.
Why does that's amazing that it takes a long time.
Yeah,
I think you should be proud of that.
Should lean into I will answer your question. Is probably 15 or 20 hours, something like that, which is just nuts because it's free. And like, you know, there's no, I don't get anything out of it other than education. And, you know, some people respond to it or something like that, maybe audience building. But it, whenever I decide, to, by the way, this is like, these are also emotional investments. And I actually don't know if they're going to pan out. Every single one that I do that is somewhat valuable, there is a moment where I don't believe it's possible to summarize it well. And I will like shut my computer and I'll walk over and talk to my wife and I'll be like, this one's not going to work. Is she like at this point has become a matter of comedy in our house. And, no, but it's true. And so like, it, first of all, that was a 3 hour and 45 minute conversation. You have to listen to it like multiple times just to get into the flow of what they're trying to say. And I want to tell you so much about this process. First of all, the medium of podcasting is so valuable, but it also is massively a transmission loss between the podcast itself and the listener. I would challenge anyone right now who has listened to the Balaji Tim Ferriss conversation, write down on a piece of paper five specific things that Balaji said. And this is, mind you, one of the like most heralded podcast tapings and episodes of the past year, I would say. Yes, for sure. And I decided to distill it without even listening, like before I listened to it for the first time, just because I knew I've listened to a lot of Ferriss conversations and I've read a lot of Balaji stuff. And I'm like, the combination of those two things is going to be magic. So I'm like, this must be done. But it is so difficult to retain with a high fidelity the level of exchange that two human beings can the number of thoughts two human beings can exchange in that period of time. It's a lot of thoughts. And so I downloaded the episode. I copied the transcript rather, and then pasted it into Word and just got to work. And it's 40,000 words. So that's like 54 pages, Arial, single space, 10 point. It's a massive document. Some of these things, like the big idea summaries that I do on Twitter, are David Perel's was 200 pages of text that you want to, and that's like, I don't know what it was. Let's call it on the order of 80 to 100,000 words.
It's a full book.
It's a full book. And you're taking it down a Twitter thread. The typical big idea summary is something like 25 tweets, which is something like 1500 words. Anyway, all of that, my most recent ones I've ignored the Twitter thread limit. And just now, like the Balaji one was 200 tweets. So I only got it down from 40,000 words to 7,500 words. But that is 12 to 15% of the conversation. So here's what I want you to do. Like try to, not you, but like anyone listening, from memory, write down what Balaji told Tim. Very difficult to do. Then read my tweet storm, which is only 12% of the conversation, and just be amazed by how much substance was in that conversation. And that's why I say it's a lossy medium. Like, and there is value to like trying to distill and summarize these things and save them and return to them as a distilled artifact. Because there is a lot of lessons that you can carry forward longitudinally through time.
Yeah. And I said to you, when I was on the phone with you, I said, you know, I told a bunch of people that they should listen to this podcast. And they were like, why should I listen to it? And I was at a loss for what to tell them because there's so much there. And I couldn't actually formulate why they should pay attention. And even after reading your summary of it, I was like, I learned so much from your summary, and I still would be like hard pressed to explain to someone why they should pay attention, exactly. Which just goes to show either I'm having trouble comprehending and explaining, or it's just a very difficult thing to do. How would you try to convince someone to listen to that episode specifically?
Yeah, I did. I believe I know that episode like better than anyone else in the world at this point, having lived with it for so long. He covers a breadth and depth of topics ranging from how India is going to win in the new post-war, he calls it like Cold War II or after Cold War II. The future of education, he believes that there is a new approach via paying people in Bitcoin for tasks, and you can incentivize the 400 million people in India alone who just came online with 4G and 5G, and you can create through a company that he started, an initiative that he started, 1729.com, is very interesting concept. He talks about things ranging from like the future of war. Like at the end, I say Tim started the conversation with that, but I ended the summary with that because I just felt like the summary needed to start with something different. But like, you know, how in a drone on drone environment will there even be an incentive for nation states to put forward human beings when you have computers making the decisions and so forth? And this is a topic that many people have opined on. Gosh, there's just such an array that he covered. Bitcoin and crypto were, I think, the meat and potatoes of the podcast, and where crypto is going with this, like he calls it nation states and neutral protocols. So when you have like, there will be a system when China and the US are duking it out, there will be a third way, a third option that that you can offer the world of these crypto networks that are completely decentralized. And how does that change human behavior and like cooperation across borders, things like that. And he's just so deeply thoughtful on these issues. And there's so many details to share.
One of the things that stuck out to me was the declining America aspect of it. And this is from your summary. You said you're quoting him summarizing him, but the internet is to the USA what the Americas were to the UK. It's a new world that it will eventually give birth to a successor. And then also, in a serious non-nuclear conflict between the US and China, China would probably win. What it made me curious about, though, was from your perspective as someone who spent time in the military, how did learning about this or summarizing it make you feel?
I believe there is a lot of truth in what he is saying. You cannot objectively look at the performance of some government institutions and organizations on the federal, state, and local levels and think that there is anything but a lot of improvement to have. And state capacity, in some ways, has declined in the most recent generation in a way that is inescapable. You must admit that it is the case. I personally believe that, I'll give you an example. Like, I traveled abroad in the early 2000s and late 1990s. And when I was at the academy and, you know, and traveled to foreign countries, I lived in Spain, lived in Belgium, and so forth and so on. People looked at you in awe that you were from the United States of America. I mean, it was palpable how people respected our country. And this doesn't get into the politics of like make America greater again or anything like that. It's not the point I'm trying to make. What I'm trying to make is America was the predominant, preeminent superpower in the world that was like massive, like you could not argue against that. And the reason was a lot of our institutions were respected, not only so on the government side and on the capitalist side, like sort of the commercial side, both of those things were like acting in harmony, and we could get big things done. And a lot of what people say is like, you know, the Pentagon was built in 16 months. How is that possible that happened in the 1940s? If you tried to build the Pentagon today, it would take you 25 years. It would not be possible. And the point Balaji is making is just look at how like India and China responded in certain ways to the pandemic. You could like, China had telemedicine. They had drones delivering supplies, like within weeks, they built a hospital in like 10 days. And so it's a failure of both imagination and execution in the United States these days. And in fact, while I served in the front office of the Secretary of Defense, and I served in the military for 11 years and like sort of seen the senior levels of government, one of the things that conspiracy theorists don't get is like there is no person behind the curtain. The government is incompetent in many ways. It's effective in some other ways. Like designing a submarine that actually works is an incredible engineering feat, with a nuclear reactor that goes X number of feet underwater, portable and pressurized and all of this stuff. That is an amazing feat. But I just feel like these days there is an unbelievable waste of resources and failure of imagination and execution on the government side. So I actually, it made me feel not good, to answer your question, but I didn't reject it out of hand. And you can take this point too far. I don't think America is a completely dysfunctional state. But yeah, so that's my response.
It's so interesting because we're so used to growing up in a world, at least personally, that the United States is at the frontier of innovation technology. And when he made the point that China could instantly create a new subway system in 9 days or something crazy like that, it kind of reframed the whole idea of America's innovation. But I wanted to ask about working with Balaji, because you put out this tweet thread and then he contacts you, and you just recently tweeted about working with him. So what has that experience been like?
Yeah, well, I want to like sort of respond to this in a way that's oblique, I believe, because he and I collaborated on a project, and he's incredibly generous in offering others credit for helping. And I come from a world in which it's perfectly acceptable to work behind the scenes and put somebody else front and center and more prominently. For what it's worth, I love his point of view. That's just sort of like, all boats rise together and so forth. But he asked me to just collaborate with him on a project. He had a thesis of, I have lots of thoughts. I often share my thoughts in public. I often am at conferences and so forth. It would be great to generate some essays from some of these things. I don't have the time to do it because I sit on 12 corporate boards and so forth. He didn't state any of that. But so we just ran an experiment where I could do almost the philosophical thing that he was advancing on the Tim Ferriss podcast. Like, I will gain something from it. I will learn. I will get paid in Bitcoin. The next logical extension is like, I will prove that I have skill in a certain area and I should earn a crypto credential that would follow me for the rest of my life and so forth. So that's like sort of the longer term vision. But yeah, I mean, we successfully, at least to now, the thing's not done yet, successfully, ran this experiment, and it's kind of cool. But I want to make sure that I leave you with the impression that, Balaji is not using ghostwriters. Everything that he posts on the internet, he either gives people credit that were collaborators with him, or he did it all himself. And the vast majority of the time, I think he just does it all himself. He's just obviously an unbelievable thinker. So,
yeah.
So that was fun. The first time I've ever made a Bitcoin.
What's your take on Bitcoin as someone who comes from a world that you grew up without Bitcoin?
Yeah, I lost my train of thought like maybe 30 minutes ago, where you asked about long-term versus short-term. And this is it. This is what I want to tweet, but I can't figure out a way to tweet it. I want to ask a question that I genuinely don't know the answer to. There was, and I looked for like an hour this morning at the transcript with Tim Ferriss and Naval Ravikant and Vitalik Buterin. I don't know how to pronounce his name exactly, but the Ethereum founder and creator. And there was a moment, I listened to this podcast several weeks ago, and there was a moment where Vitalik appeared to admit something that is like, I believe, the Achilles heel to like crypto and decentralized networks. And I want to find this sentence because I want to ask a question to the lazy web or to experts who actually understand this stuff. And I think all of these things were like intellectually resolved in advance like a decade ago. But I'm now just like learning about this in a serious way, or at least trying to learn. And it has to do with, once you have a completely decentralized network and everything is trustless, there's smart contracts and, instantly executable things based on code, not on you know, and based also on like social consensus that's built into the code and so forth. It's my point of view that anytime you have a human creation like this, even though it is a trustless, decentralized thing, there will be an edifice that's built on top of this where people will try to gain control of these things. And so my posit, my thesis is that it will become centralized in by dint of like someone attempting to do this via the most powerful people gaining together and forking off a new Bitcoin or a new currency or whatever the new Ethereum thing is. And you can like continuously fork these things in a way that you gain a centralized power from it. And how is that not going to occur in the long run, say decades in the future? That is something that I try and trying to genuinely explain to myself. And I know I'm sort of not succinctly and I'm not putting this beautifully or elegantly. But I would love to like have Naval's 5-minute take on that, 2-minute take on that. Yeah. So anyway.
Well, Balaji and Naval and Vitalik are probably the best people to ask that type of thing. And it's so interesting because with the internet, you could tag them on Twitter and get responses from people like that. And it's
wild in that way.
It's crazy in 2 seconds. One thing I wanted to talk about with you is the 10X creator. You're building a course. What is that all about? And how did you come to get to this idea?
Yeah. The idea of 10X anything, and specifically 10X engineers, is a much maligned and hated concept in Silicon Valley. Engineers hate the idea of 10X engineers, but of course there is some validity to the concept. Because as Steve Jobs says and said, and others have said, some engineers are more productive by several orders of magnitude than other engineers. And, you know, Steve Wozniak is a great example of this. And they could spend, you know, 10 minutes of their time thinking through and solving problems is worth several hours of other people's times. I believe the same thing is true these days of creators. And the reason is you just can observe people like Jack Butcher and observe people who are prolific on the internet these days. And they're not just better at creating great content or products. They're better at creating systems and then leveraging those systems. So they're better at 3 skills. They're better thinkers/writers or creators. They're better at systems building and they're better at leveraging. So selling or promoting or whatever. And the people who, it's the combination of those 3 things that decisively set them apart in like on the internet, if you will. And so they're not just a bit better than you or me. They are 10X better. And I would say 1,000 times better. Now, it doesn't mean that you and I can't get there. And you know, hopefully we'll all strive to gain these skills and then put them together in a systematic fashion. But I really am proud to like inhabit a layer of this economy where I can help people do this. And I think selfishly, I think if I help enough people become better creators and publish products, successful products, I will then inevitably get much better. And then I will be publishing successful products. It's almost like Tim Ferriss deconstructs world-class performers. I would like to deconstruct 10X creators and like really learn and apply what they do well. And over a 2-decade period of time, I think I can become a much better creator, like a 10X creator. I'm not at that stage. And I'm perfectly fine to accept that. But my course is partnered with Wes Kao and Gagan Biani's new company, and Shreyas as the head of product. It's called Maven, and Maven is this new philosophy school of thought that cohort-based courses are going to have better outcomes for students than self-paced or MOOC sort of style courses. And so I want to, and I will, I've launched it, I've announced it. In June, I'm going to help 36 creators build a product, and I'm going to neck it down so that they will closely define a core scope, an MVP. And I want to get them across this chasm where it's really hard to get the ideas and your expertise and your skills out of your head onto paper and then packaged into a product that you can sell and successfully do so. So I just feel like I'm proud. Maybe it comes from my speechwriting background. My product is going to be help other people productize themselves.
What makes a great creator?
I think great creators have a set of constraints that help them produce prolifically valuable content. And they have a point of view that resolves down to maybe half of a dozen ideas, big ideas, that then they say 100 different ways from Sunday. But really, it's like they have maybe a decade or two of experience that they are applying, that they have like combined, and as Jack Butcher says, and I'll just steal this, like they have a set of competencies, they have like a personal character, and they have a curiosity that is insatiable on one axis. So they're constantly pursuing this, like they're pulling the thread on the thing that they are curious about, combining that with a growing set of competencies and their personal character. In other words, their like personality. And the combination of those three things is unbeatable. You can't, it's like you become, as they say, an army of one. And you're the only person that's doing what you're doing if you combine those three things. But first and foremost, and this is adopted from Naval and many others probably throughout history, like the thing that would cause you to fail, if you're going to use the principle of inversion, the Charlie Munger principle of inversion, if you want to be a terrible creator, be not curious. Like follow your curiosity is the inverse of, it's the secret. Like irrepressible curiosity is the singular thing that I would say creates a great creator.
So one of the ones you did, I think the first summarization you did was Jack Butcher. And you go through Jack Butcher's entire archive, start in 2013, and you find how he distilled his philosophy. What were some of the things that surprised you going along this journey?
I think he discovered his philosophy and like further refined and iterated it over time. What's amazing about the most prolific people who have a strong point of view is how they didn't have that in previous years. Like they, like dozens of names flooding into my head right now, but anyone that you respect and admire online or wherever, they weren't born like that. It was like a crucible that they went through at some point that was difficult, that like beat those ideas into their head. And those ideas, like sort of that unique set of experiences, this is why you can't be interesting unless you do interesting things. Like you can't be fascinating without like at least exploring some side of humanity that is like in a very real way, a visceral way. But what Jack discovered, what I discovered about Jack and just like inhabiting, intellectually channeling him, this is what I would, like, those are the verbs that's the verb I use, channel, is what, for me, I was actually pursuing my own line of curiosity. It was like, how the hell did he become so declarative on Twitter? Like, how is he so fucking convincing on Twitter? And, he's a designer. He's known as a designer, but I actually just don't think of him as a designer. I can never think of him that way. He's obviously compelling as a designer, but his true skill is communication, and design is the medium that he uses to communicate. He's just a singularly good communicator of an idea. And the reason he creates these great designs is because he's like, what is the most interesting way to communicate this thing, this thought, this concept? And so I said, did that like evolve over time? So I was simply trying to ask myself a question. Was he born with it or not? And so I just looked at that time in early 2020, I downloaded his whole Twitter timeline, and there were fewer than 3,000 tweets at the time, which is mind-boggling because he tweets so often nowadays. And he can do that because he sort of has the point of view completely hammered in now. But he, at the early stages, wasn't nearly as declarative. Like, it was more like there were qualifiers. There were avoidable qualifiers that he would attach to a thought. Now he just deletes those qualifiers. You know what I mean? He takes a position, like a, even if it's not nuanced, he will just state a declarative thing and let other people react to it. But it took 10 years or so in the corporate advertising world, doing this on behalf of Ferrari, on behalf of, you know, Nike and many big corporations. The imperative to convey a thought succinctly is what he learned in that experience. And now he's applying it in a different context on his own, but the magic was like sort of steeled to use like a manufacturing metaphor. It was like the smelting of it occurred in the corporate advertising world. And you could just see it naturally evolve. And then I'll make one final point about this. When I like just had an Excel spreadsheet of 3,000 tweets of his, and you start to like group them, what you do is you take them all apart in a Microsoft Word file. You like take everything into an individual atomic unit, and then you group all of the similar ones together and reorder them into some narrative flow. That's essentially what I do. And when I did that with 3,000 tweets, only 20 big ideas fell out of it. Like, he basically says 20 things over and over again. And so I believed from that experience, you could do that with anyone who's prolific. So I started to actually just tackle people one at a time as they sort of seized my attention.
What was so interesting to me was realizing that Jack later said that he didn't even realize he had 20 big ideas and that he was just filtering in. What do you think allows you to be able to pull out those ideas?
An external perspective. I would say most people won't go to the effort to summarize the previously written stuff that they have put out into the world. They're fixated on the next big idea that they have or the next input or thing that they're consuming. As a total aside, the people who are great creators also are active consumers. In like the centuries ago, people would say there's a phrase called reading for action. And you aren't reading as a purely passive activity. You're reading actively, which means literally creating during the process of consumption. And that's what like makes David Perel unstoppable, is he is consuming for action. And in fact, that's what makes all great creators great, is that Paul Graham tweeted about this the other day. He said, and I know I'm off topic, but I'm just going to keep going. He said something like, one day I was watching a video of a great, let's call it Jack Nicklaus, like a golfer or like a great basketball player. And the thing that I noticed is when they're watching other golfers or other basketball players, they are paying the closest attention. Like, they are wrapped in attention. They're paying extremely close attention to the details of this. And like, it's almost like they are consuming in order to create better, to play better, to do something better. And I truly believe that like the best creators are the most discerning and keenest observers. I have no idea what topically we were just talking about, but I wanted to get that across in this conversation. Like, Jack is constantly tweeting, but I just saw the other day he tweeted something that just like blew my mind, because it was a much better way of saying something that Balaji had just said. Wow. And I haven't talked to Jack about this, but like, it was one of my summary tweets that like, I can't remember exactly what point he was trying to make. I think I know what it was. Geographically, people can connect with people who are not geographically contiguous. Can connect ideologically these days. And like, you can create a nation state of people that are not geographically in the same place. And like, it was probably 280 characters, that like the point that was made, and it was made well, but Jack put it in about 10 characters. It was just like insane how he put, how he distilled it down. And I'm wondering, like, I think what he often does, and I've had many conversations with him where the next day there will be something that we talked about that he'll tweet beautifully. And he wasn't listening to our conversation and just letting it go like down, like out of him. It was like going into him so he would create something out of it. He was reading, he was consuming, he was talking for action. It's like you and I are going to have this wonderful conversation. Like, it would be a shame if we didn't create 10 things out of it tomorrow. But very few people do that when they have great conversations. And in fact, David Perel often talks about this. He'll be like, he has a whole slide about this. Every one of his essays is, the germ of it is a conversation that he had with someone. And so like, he doesn't just have, great creators don't just have conversations for no purpose. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think I'm going down a rabbit hole.
The point of creators paying close attention to other creators and athletes paying close attention to other athletes struck me as so true and made me realize what I do when I listen to a podcast now, as opposed to what I did a year ago when I didn't have a podcast, which is like understanding how is that person asking that question? What is the lead up? What is the transition? How did that happen? And exactly. When you're in that seat, you're then forced to think about things in ways that you might not have before. So just interesting.
Perfect sense. Yeah. And I mean, congratulations, by the way, 100 episodes in 200 days is insane. You are prolific in your own right. And it's really cool to see. And you, I mean, I can't believe how deep you have gone on my background and stuff today. So it's clearly impressive that you can do this every other day for 200 straight days with 200 different personalities and backgrounds and so forth. So that's really cool. Lots of bodies of work that you have intellectually channeled. But yeah, I mean, there's like this idea of creators consulting other creators. And there's a famous picture of this quartet, this music quartet, Elvis Presley. I'm going to get the other three incorrect. So I won't even attempt it, but there's a quartet of musicians, that are consulting one another in this wonderful, like iconic picture. And it just goes to show like Elvis Presley was not a genius in a vacuum. He was just asking other creators how they were doing it. And that's cool. Like, so it's just like across any discipline, across any medium, people do the same thing when they're, and I guess maybe what, now that I start to say it out loud, like I have been obsessed with the creative process for a long time. And I suppose that starts to like, just the process of talking to you today has like reinforced for me that might be like the thread that I've always loved to pull. And maybe I should just like lean into this direction.
How did you think about running as a creative act?
I thought you might ask something like that. In other words, combining running and creativity. And I don't have a great answer for you, but now I'm definitely going to think about this. Steve Prefontaine has a great quote that like running is a work of art that you can only understand to the extent that you like, I need to look this up, Steve Prefontaine. But like, it's like you are capable of understanding my races only to the extent that you can understand like a piece of art, something like that. I want to be so excellent in this one activity that it becomes, I'm raising it to an art form. And I suppose that is maybe where I would go with this. Like pursuing something, when I was in senior in high school, like there was a guy who was way, way more talented than me. He was the state champion in Ohio where we grew up. I was good, but I wasn't at his level. And I remember I was going to bed one night. I was talking to my dad and he said, you know, one day you're going to beat him. And I said, that's not possible. I will, that like, you don't understand, like he has talent. And, my dad like had this wonderful faith, like that, you know, hard work over time, begets results and like success is inevitable through hard work over time, which is a wonderful phrase, a turn of phrase. And, the best part about that phrase is you have to define hard work. Like that phrase is true only if you define like work hard, if you work hard enough, something like that. But turns out I actually did beat him in college because I had worked my ass off. And, you know, I think he just didn't catch the bug in a way that on the collegiate level, like I did. And so, I mean, there is such a thing as innate talent, but you can develop in a way that, like, I just posted this thing about Bryson DeChambeau the other day. He was just interviewed at the Masters and he said something to the effect of, hard work over time begins to look like extreme talent. Like if you work hard enough for long enough, it actually starts to look like extreme talent. I think that there's something to that. It's not a new idea, but he put it in a really memorable way.
Over the course of time, if you work hard enough and you're dedicated enough at something, it's going to look like extreme talent, Bryson DeChambeau.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention? Anything else you'd like to explore? This has been a tremendous amount of fun for me getting to talk to you about these topics. And
yeah. Can you tell me about your athletic background? Because you seem to like have a wonderful way of combining people's intellectual pursuits with sports. Can we talk about that?
What? Sure. When I was 12, I probably reached my athletic peak. I was incredible at basketball, not incredible at basketball. I was good at basketball. I was on the Little League baseball team. And then puberty hit and everyone grew and got big. And I was like, what is going on? So I guess that love for me of sports and athletics goes back to my childhood. To stay in that ecosystem, I started a Knicks blog and was covering the New York Knicks and met Amari Stoudemire and went to media day. And it's just been my trajectory in life has been combining sports and athletic achievement. And I think there's something so real about what happens in the arena and also creativity of writing and journalism and figuring out what is going into the mind of those people. So it's a really astute observation on your part. I love the two aspects of life, and I think that you do as well from diving into your background.
Yeah, yeah. And you've interviewed 100 people now, probably well more than that. What are the things like that stick out to you in terms of how they think? In other words, are there strains of thought that start to have emerged now that you start to pull on that are like cross? Like, what is the pattern recognition that you have now that has emerged in your own experience throughout all of these conversations?
It's consistency is like anything and everything. And it's the number one thing that you just realize that if you want to be great at anything, whether that's sports, athletic achievement, or podcasting or writing, it's like, it's a reps thing. And so often what you think of as talent or amazing God-given ability is just people doing it over and over and over again. You know, it's like some people say like, Danny, you're talented at podcasting. And I think I have such a long way to go, but I say to them, imagine doing a podcast every other day. Like you're going to get good at it. You're going to get better than the normal person. And I don't believe that I'm particularly talented at podcasting or look at the first three episodes and hopefully look at the episodes, this episode in you know, 10 years. Right. So I think that it's just a matter of reps. And that's what I've gotten from talking to so many people in so many different areas.
Yeah. By the way, Jack keeps coming up, but my goodness, the concept that you just described, in other words, you get better with reps and consistency, is so true. And there are people that put this in any number of ways, but of course, Jack came up with a great way to put it. And I think he tweeted this the other day and I was just like, holy shit. Cause of course he used the principle of inversion again. And he's like, he's tweeted, there are the, what is it? Something like, there is no shitty 50th podcast. The reason is no one makes it past the 10th. And like, if you do 50, it will be good. Like it's inevitable. Like he put it in, you know, probably 10 words, but I loved how he said that.
And I think about that constantly, like there's no shitty 1,000th podcast and how that's what I'm playing for. And if I do this for 5 years and if I do this for 10 years, it's going to be something special because there's no other way. There's nothing else that could happen other than it be something special, because no one gets to the 5-year mark. Very few people get to the 10-year mark. You look at someone like Joe Rogan, has been doing it for 11 years, and we look at him like he's the greatest of all time. But what's going to happen if I do this for 20? You know what I mean? So it's exciting for me. It's really exciting.
Oh, totally. You've got, like you said to me on the phone, you've got 20 years on him.
Yeah.
So watch out for you in 20 years. Super cool. Man.
I believe it.
And one final comment from my side is like, there's this phrase, this is like a 2,000-year-old thought, but I think I put it in these words. I believe I wrote this at some point like 6 years ago. Like the only possible product of sloppy thinking is sloppy writing. And just to apply it back to what we were just talking about, like the only possible product of 1,000 podcast episodes is a very good podcast host. Like that's the only possible product.
Yeah.
And especially if you're deliberate about it, which you certainly are, my goodness.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. I'm certainly better off after this conversation. I can't wait to make this episode into 10 different clips so we could put it and bring 10 different ideas so that they can be spread on their own. I appreciate you, man. Where can people find more from you?
Yeah, Twitter, specifically at jmikolay, jmikolay. And I have a cool URL from my newsletter. It's letter.substack.com. And I don't know how that was available like 2 years after the company started. I need to rebrand it though. I have no idea where I want to take it, but those are the two places.
Awesome. And those will be in the show notes. Thank you, Justin, for the time, attention, and wisdom. I really appreciate you, man.
Thanks, Danny. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I really appreciate you listening to the final seconds. It really means the world to me, and I wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Also, please note that episodes, if you'd like the video version or you'd like to see some clips from this episode, you can do that at youtube.com/Danny Miranda. You can subscribe there as well. And finally, you can expect new episodes of the podcast Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. As always, I'll see you guys in the next one. Have a great one. Peace.